Okay, thank you, Dr. Reddy, and thank you, Dr. Wheaton, for organizing the current session in your capacity as C7 chair. And thanks, everybody, for coming. So I'll talk a little bit about what we've been working on at the Corn Host Plant Resistance Research Unit of the USDA ARS in Mississippi State. I work on aflatoxin resistance caused by Aspergillus flavus. We work in Starkville because that's a great place to grow green, moldy corn. Don't eat this, by the way, if you ever see that. Aflavus is an opportunistic, it's a saprophyte, but it will become a pathogen if given the chance. It becomes an economic problem, but because it produces a secondary metabolite, which is highly toxic in animals that eat it, and causes many different problems in development of children as well. So this is something that we really don't want in our food. So we've been working on the problem. It's hard to work on because it's very low heritability, because the problem is huge for the animals that eat it, but not so bad for the plant itself. So it doesn't, maize doesn't tend to have such a big problem with the ear rots caused by Aspergillus flavus as it does by many other diseases. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the background work that we've done for about a minute so that you can see where we've been and where we're going with this work. We've worked quite a bit on QTL mapping. We have four different QTL mapping populations of about 200 genotypes each with three different donor source markers. We do have some good stably resistant donor lines, including MP313E, MP717, and MP715, and we have four populations, including this one, in two different backgrounds. Where we found QTLs, 7 or 8, they're the same 7 in both, with MP313E. And we're doing marker-assisted selection with four of them to create near isogenic lines, both in the same crosses and in different crosses, so that we can confirm the phenotypic effect of these QTL. We found only one, with MP717, and we found five QTL with MP715, one of which we think is in common with the one from MP313E. So if you look at all of the QTL that have been mapped from our lab and also other labs with other donors, we did a meta-analysis on all of these maps and found many different meta-QTL that show up in many of them. And most of these are the ones that we're mapping with, that we're selecting with markers to create the near isogenic lines, including the ones on 2, 3, 4, and 5. So looking at just one of the crosses with which we made near isogenic lines, that we now have the fixed lines and 2 years of field data, is very encouraging. For the first year, we only had fixed lines with one QTL each from MP313E in a VA35 background. And so looking at the last year's data, you find that if you have the susceptible parent or one of the near isogenic lines that did not happen to get any of the major QTL, you have very high levels of aflatoxin. This is measured in parts per billion, and this is considered very high. In the resistant parent, it was low. It's still higher than what you want to eat because we actually inject the spores into the developing ear, thus overcoming most of the lines of defense that the corn plant has. So at this point, 26 is quite low. And what you see up here are the QTL. Individual QTLs are reducing the amount of aflatoxin resistance in approximately the same amounts as the QTL explained variation in the mapping population to begin with. So that's pretty cool. So the second year, we did it again, but now we also have combinations of different QTL. Now this year, our summer was very weird. It was very cool. It was very rainy, not something that we normally get in Mississippi. And we got every disease known to corn growing on our plants. As Aflavus is not a very competitive plant, in some of our individuals, including our resistant line, we had less Aflavus than we'd like. So we're going to repeat all of this. But you can still see a reduction in aflatoxin. And where we begin to pyramid more than one QTL, we see some excellent control, reaching the levels of the original resistant plant. And we've only got two or three QTL at a time. So this is really encouraging because we don't have single QTL explaining large amounts of the variation, but they seem to work together very nicely. So this is incredibly encouraging. So moving on from there, because the QTL are fairly large, we're moving in kind of big pieces of the chromosome with our markers, and in those fairly big pieces of the chromosome, we know that we have some genes that the breeders are not going to want. MP313E, for example, is very tall and very late and tends to fall over and low yielding. Not necessarily something that a farmer wants to grow, unfortunately. So we're trying to narrow down to individual genes, which is very tricky, but we thought we would try genome-wide association mapping. So in order to do a genome-wide selection, of course, you need, in a plant like maize where linkage disequilibrium breaks down very fast, you need probably a million markers to make sure that you've sampled all of your different little linkage disequilibrium blocks. And using genotype by sequencing, or GBS data, and the maize HapMap2 resources, imputation will allow you to get pretty close to a million markers. We didn't quite get a million, but we got a lot, okay? So we set up an aflatoxin association panel, including all of the known sources of resistance at the time that we could get our hands on, and a bunch of other diversity as well, plus things that had been used in other association mapping panels to try and tie it to theirs as well. And we came up with 300 individuals that were genotyped with genotype by sequencing, and we had almost 500,000 SNPs, okay, removing the ones with minor allele frequency, less than 5%, and using the ones with imputation, we ended up with about 260,000 SNPs that we thought would be good for GWAS. So we ran an MLM GWAS study using TASEL, and we had seven different environments in which we measured the 300 maize inbred lines that had been test crossed onto a common tester, VA35, because if you use inbred lines and you inject them with aflavus, they tend to look really bad. But using the hybrids, we phenotyped, we've got the genotypes, and we found over 5,000 associations better than P to the minus 4, and there were associations on every chromosome. But looking at the Manhattan graph here, okay, these are all of our chromosomes, all of the markers, here's our p-values. In certain areas of the chromosomes, in specific environments, our p-values were really low, and we were excited about that. But looking at the false discovery rate, you have to draw a line, a cutoff of what you believe is actually real. So the false discovery rate actually excluded all of our 5,000 associations except 8 SNP trait associations corresponding to 3 genes, and 1 SNP that was in a sequence that was not in a gene or near a gene or linked to a gene, so we wonder what that one is. Now, unfortunately for us, these 3 genes all encoded uncharacterized proteins. So we still don't know what they're doing, but we do have a new PhD student who has a perfect project now, so she'll start taking a look at those. The conserved motifs in these genes suggest that they might have a regulatory role, okay, so that's great. They're predicted to potentially affect a large number of downstream proteins, or the DNA itself. None of them co-located with previously reported QTL. Of course, it wouldn't be that easy. But we still have a lot of information, okay? So there are only 3 genes exceed the FDR, but I tend to think that the FDR is too strict. I think we're throwing out some of our babies with the bathwater. So looking at the 3 genes there on chromosomes 3, 9, and 10, and we don't know what they're doing. So looking at some of the other SNP trait associations that didn't quite reach the false discovery rate, we found that if we looked at associations that were better than 10 to the minus 6, showed up in more than one environment, and showed up repeatedly, we did find that there were multiple associations in the same regions, and we have a lot more information on those for things like gene models, expression, linkage disequilibrium information, to predict what these 23 regions or genes might be doing. And actually, it's not just 23 genes, because linkage blocks, we took into account how big linkage blocks were with our disequilibrium, and we came up with about 67 possible genes linked to those 23 SNP regions. Okay, and this is what we have, knowing that at least half of these are not going to be real, okay, but what we end up with are a lot of metabolic and catabolic functions, two that are disease resistance, known disease resistance, that's great, several that are transcription factors, which, again, we think that we're probably looking at regulatory elements or something in a major pathway here. And there are three of them with MIB stress response and one work-resistance stress response factor. So we think that we're on the right track here, all right? But we still don't have a mechanism, okay? And that's probably for a couple of reasons. First, there's probably not just one mechanism that's going to give resistance to aflavus because, as I mentioned before, it's not a big problem for maize. So there's probably several different ways that it helps to mitigate whatever stress is being caused by aflavus. But I'd like to narrow in on a couple so that we can work a little bit more on future projects. Now, one thing that you can do, looking at those 67 genes, you can look at where it tends to be expressed. Now, we don't have this data yet for plants that have been injected with aflavus. We will have that later. But we do have this online database of expression for thousands of different maize genes. And for several, half of them, we find that they are expressed in the embryo or in the seeds or in the immature cobs, which is where we want the resistance against aflatoxin, against the ear rots, to be. So that's also a good hint, although it's still not proof. Now we need to run this for our lines with aflavus stressed genes and see if it's the same. Now, when we look at GWAS, you get kind of a big picture. Some of them might be false positives, a lot of them might be missed. So we also wanted to look at candidate gene analysis, and we do have some candidate genes. That's where you look at individual genes or small groups of genes at the same time to do your association, and you don't have problems with multiple testing that you do have with GWAS. So we did this to start off with the 31 genes in the chitinase gene family, because we know that chitinases are important against fungi. Okay? So we decided to take a look at all of them. We went and we got SNP polymorphisms within the 31 genes, and we found, for these, we were able to find five different genes with SNP trait associations, but they weren't any better than 10 to the minus 4, okay? So we haven't really gotten anything that leaps out at us with GWAS. But in addition, we went and mapped these back in our QTL populations. If we didn't have something that segregated within the gene, we found the closest nearest flanking SSR markers, and we mapped those. Note this one in red, because it shows up again. So when we looked in the four QTL mapping populations, we found three with very large QTL associated with them. This one here, there was nothing there before. And then when we ran this marker, which happens to be directly in the gene, chitinase at 1.05, we get this huge QTL showing up in multiple environments. Very encouraging. This one was the one that also showed up with association mapping results. Very encouraging. And this one, actually these two, were under QTL that were previously reported, and we've already got neuroisogenic lines for them. Now we have a hypothesis of what is causing the QTL that we've been breeding for. Very exciting. And so in summary, we've got 10 QTL identified, we've got neuroisogenic lines, we've got some known genes. These are still hypothesized, but they all look very good. Okay? One other thing that we wanted to do, as I mentioned, we still have all this other data. We have those 5,000 associations that were not high enough to say I really believe them, but if we put them all together, can we come up with something? So we decided to do a pathway analysis, which has been done in the past with gene expression studies and is beginning to be used now with GWAS data in human disease studies. So we said, well, we could do it too. This is maize disease. The only difference being that we don't have as many annotated pathways in maize as we'd like. But what we did is we took our original SNPs. Okay, so we started with these SNPs. With imputation, we added up to 400,000, removing minor allele frequency back down to 261,000. Okay, and then we got SNP associations and effects of every single one of those. We mapped those onto first what's called a tag SNP, because they usually come in blocks of linked SNPs. We took the one that had the highest association of the linked blocks, and then we mapped those to the nearest gene that was within LD. If it was not in LD with the gene, we removed it from the analysis. If it was an LD with two genes, we put both genes in the analysis. And then we found where are those genes in the pathway. And we came up with 25,000 genes that we mapped a SNP to, and 298 pathways with those mapped SNPs. Then we assigned each pathway an enrichment score based on the p-value of the GWAS. If the p-value for our GWAS was kind of high with a couple of genes, then the pathway got high. Or if there was one gene that was really high, then the pathway got high. If there was nothing in the pathway, then the pathway score was low. And so the scores are called q-values, and you can assign a false discovery rate, and we ended up with 17 pathways whose FDR was better than the false discovery rate. But one in particular we got really excited about, because not only was the FDR way, way, way lower than our actual value, it's jasmonic acid biosynthesis, which makes very good sense. It is a plant hormone in response to biotic stress. So we kept hypothesizing that that's what we're looking for, and this is what we found. The other ones are not as significant. Some of them we think are related to jasmonic acid in that we have, for example, branched amino acid chain forms of jasmonic acid is what tends to be the active form of the plant hormone, and these are coming up as well down here. So now we're taking a look. We have all of these new possible candidates. We have all of the downstream response genes for jasmonic acid. We've got genes in the jasmonic acid pathway itself, I'm getting excited, that we can look at. So in this case, we still don't have the mechanism, but at least now we have somewhere that we can grab hold and start looking. So, and I thank you.